taking their place in a long true line of everyday Americans,
helping to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. This is the Constitution Study on the America Out Loud Network with your host, Paul Engel.
Pay the bills, stay out of jail, love the neighbors and have a few good friends. Every day you are everyday Americans.
Hello there, everyday Americans, and welcome to the Constitution Study. This is where we read and study the Constitution. We teach the rising generation to be free. I'm glad you could join me today. I was doing a little research on some of the writings, the revolutionary writings of John Adams. And in a discussion about the British Empire, he wrote this line. He said, "They define a republic to be a government of laws and not of men." Now, those of you who know, the Constitution created a republic, not a democracy, because in a republic, we don't vote for everything. Everybody doesn't get a say in what happens in the majority rules. See, in our republic, we elect representatives to exercise our power, and we bind them down with a constitution, a set of laws they are bound to follow. But what happens when those that are supposed to be bound by the Constitution don't act that way? What happens when the opinion of man supersedes the rule of law? Are we still a republic? Or, to borrow a term from that is popular among certain political factions, are we a republic in name only? Today, I want to take a look at some examples of the fact that maybe we're not as much a republic as we thought. Of course, again, a lot of people still think we're a democracy, but that's a whole different issue. No, today I want to see, or I want to look at this idea that rather than a government of laws, we have a government of men and women in black robes, that we no longer are ruled by the Constitution of the United States, but by judges, men and women in black robes who claim the authority to rule over the rest of us. Now, that's not to say that the opinions these judges offer are always wrong. My focus isn't on the rightness or wrongness of these opinions, although some of them are right and some of them are wrong. It's this idea that everything is, how much of our lives are now being ruled on by judges. And this was reinforced as I was reviewing the oral arguments in the recent Supreme Court's case, Dobbs versus Jackson's Women's Health. This you may remember as the Mississippi abortion case. And as I was reviewing that, one of the justices, Justice Sotomayor, made the point that the court, well, they're the last stop. They are the ultimate arbiter of the rightness of the constitutionality of a law. And, well, that's an issue I'm going to have to deal with in more detail later. But it got me thinking about judges and this mantle they have taken upon themselves. Now, let's start in Lexington, Kentucky. Now, a city ordinance was passed in Lexington, Kentucky, banning the use of no-knock warrants. Basically, the point was within the city, they would no longer issue warrants that allowed police to enter a location without knocking and announcing themselves first. Now, I kind of see both sides of the argument here. On the one hand, as a homeowner, if someone comes barging into my home without announcing themselves, well, they're likely to get an unpleasant response. And then to be held accountable for, let's say, resisting or otherwise dealing with an armed intruder, only to find out later that it was law enforcement and I'm going to be treated differently for fighting them off, I find that unfair. How can you accuse me of resisting arrest when the people attempting to arrest me didn't tell me they were police, didn't show me a warrant? How can you claim that I assaulted a police officer when the officer never announced themselves? So on the one hand, I understand that no-knock warrants are not generally a good thing. But on the other hand, I do see the law enforcement's point of view. So if you've got a suspect that you're trying to take into custody, one with a history of violence, especially violence towards law enforcement, do you want to give them an advantage? Do you want to lose the element of surprise? And I kind of see the justification for them in rare circumstances. Now, whether or not the city of Lexington was right in their decision to ban no-knock warrants, the police unions, the Fraternal Order of Police Bluegrass Lodge No. 4, filed suit to strike down the ordinance. Now, they claim that the suit violates the city's collective bargain agreement because the officers, the union, has the right to bargain when it comes to police department policy. It also claims that no-knock warrants could jeopardize the health and safety of officers, and that a state law passed this year that limits but does not ban no-knock warrants supersedes the county ordinance. So here you have competing questions, right? The city says, we don't want no-knock warrants. The state says, well, we're going to have limited no-knock warrants. The police union says, we don't like no-knock warrants. The answer comes down to a judge. Now, in this case, a judge in Fayette County dismissed the lawsuit. The judge said, Judge Kimberly Bunnell said that the elected officials have the power to enact public policy without agreement with the police union. Now, is that a good answer, a bad answer? That's not my point here. It's another example where in a supposedly Republican form of government, the question of how the servants of the people in the form of law enforcement, how they are authorized to enact, ultimately did not come down to the representatives of the city. It did not come down to the representatives of the state. It came down to a judge. Now, the union believed they had a grievance against the city, so they petitioned the government, in this case the county of Fayette in Kentucky, for a redress of the grievance. Now, this is, to me, is not a bad situation, right? I don't see this as a terrible, oh my God, what's going on? But to me, I wanted to use it as a baseline to understand a process. The process of the representatives of the people at the different levels of government establishing law, and then the ability of a party that believes they may be injured by the law having a chance to redress that grievance. Now, that's a fairly benign one. I use that, again, that's as a baseline. Because now, well, things get a lot more interesting and a lot more consequential. See, a district judge in Missouri, one Matthew Schlelp, issued an injunction against President Biden's vaccine mandates for healthcare workers in 10 states. Now, let's stop and think about this for a second. Let's back up. The Centers for, well, first of all, Biden announced a mandate for federal workers and contractors. So he announces this mandate. And of course, this was announced long before they actually started putting it in place. But as part of that process, the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare, collectively known as CMS, they decided that if you are a healthcare worker at a facility that accepts either Medicaid or Medicare patients, you are therefore a federal contractor. Therefore, you're subject to this mandate announced by their boss, President Biden. Now, I'm not here to discuss the validity of the mandates. These mandates are unconstitutional. They're illegal. They're wrong in so many ways. Today, I'm focusing on the judicial process. So you have this mandate put in place. You have this regulation put in place that if you're a healthcare worker, you have to get vaccinated. Of course, there are many healthcare workers that don't much like this idea. So what do? They sue, right? They petition their government for a redress of grievance. Well, that's what it means when you sue somebody. You're asking the government to say, hey, I got a problem here. I want redress. And in this one district, you have a judge that says, you know what? But while we're waiting, while we're figuring this, we're going to issue an injunction. Quoting the judge, CMS mandate raises substantial questions of law and fact that must be determined as discussed throughout this opinion. Because it is evident, CMS significantly understates the burden that its mandate would impose on the ability of healthcare facilities to provide proper care and thus save lives. The public has an interest in maintaining the status quo while the merits of the case are determined. So listen to what the judge says. So the judge says, listen, there are serious questions of law. There are things that must be determined here. Okay, no problem with that. But what's interesting is that he says that, CMS understates the burden that the mandate would have on the healthcare facilities, their ability to provide proper care and thus save lives. Is the issue here the burden that it places, that it's an undue burden on the healthcare facilities, or is it the fact that it violates the rights of the owners of those facilities, that it violates the rights of the employees of that facility? See, my issue here isn't with the fact that he put an injunction in place until they've had a chance to determine the merits of the case. I think that was the right thing to do. My concern is look at why he did it. It isn't a question of the rights of the healthcare facility owners or the rights of the employees. No, no, no. It's that, oh, well, we have a problem here. We might have problems effectively staffing these facilities to provide proper care. He never looks at the fact that says, you know what? If this goes into place, there are going to be people that are intimidated into taking an injection that is generally a violation of their conscience, but they're intimidated into it, and that's something you can't give back. In other words, if the mandate turns around and says is found unconstitutional, everybody who got vaccinated that didn't want to can't go back and say, okay, now unvaccinate me. That wasn't part of the discussion. It all had to do with, could these healthcare facilities provide proper care? Now, I am not in this judge's head. I don't know all the details. But to me, we now have a decision not based on law, right? Because there was no law created. Congress did not write a law. It was not pursuant to the Constitution of the United States. We're not dealing with the legal issues there. We're dealing with a mandate. And while I'm glad that Judge Shelp issued the injunction until they could hear all the facts, I'm still waiting to see how they respond to all the facts. And my concern is that we end up with a pragmatic answer. Can healthcare facilities provide sufficient care with this mandate in place? Not the rights of the people. And therefore, violating due process. See, the Free Legal Dictionary defines due process as a judicial or governmental process designed to protect the rights of the individual. This isn't due process. The injunction has the effect of due process, but it isn't truly due process because it's not based on the rights of the individuals. It's based on the impact to the public as a whole. So in other words, we now have, well, since this time, I believe CMS has suspended their vaccination mandate because of all the problems we're running into. Because, again, it's not just a Missouri judge. Before I go on, though, listen to the list of states that are covered by this. North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, Wyoming, New Hampshire, Missouri, Kansas, Iowa, Alaska, and Arkansas. I find that interesting because all those states are not within the district that this judge is serving. So my guess it has to do with the lawsuit itself and the parties to the lawsuit. So that to me is why that's a little, you know, kind of a broad range of states. But you see, he's not the only one. Another judge, District Judge Gary Van Tattenhove, he also issued an injunction. He also is blocking the mandate. But see, now he has a different reason. Quoting from the order, "This is not a case about whether vaccines are effective. They are. Nor is this a case about whether government at some level and in some circumstances can require citizens to obtain vaccines. It can. The question presented here is narrow. Can the president use congressionally delegated authority to manage the federal procurement of goods and services to impose vaccines on the employees of federal contractors and subcontractors? In all likelihood, the answer to that question is no." So here we have an interesting, here's a different twist. All right, so first, are vaccines effective? I'm sorry, but the science says not nearly as much as they think. They may be effective in the short term, but in the long term, they are not. Then he said, well, does government at some level and in some circumstances, can they require citizens to obtain vaccines? Well, if they follow due process, yes, they can. And I've talked about that before. It's not simply that the government has no interest in requiring vaccines, but they have to protect the rights of the individuals. Now, many people point to the Jacobson case as an example of the government requiring a vaccine, but you see, they kind of miss the details. Little things like state actors versus federal actors, and the question of due process. Jacobson, there was probable cause that Jacobson had been exposed to a deadly pathogen, smallpox. So the question was, could he be, did the state government have a legitimate interest in protecting public safety via requiring him to be vaccinated, quarantined, or pay a fine? A minimal fine, by the way. It was only $5, if memory serves. So there are situations where the requirement of a vaccination can be legal. So he's true. He's got it right there. But what's interesting here is the question presented is narrow. Can the president use congressionally delegated authority to mandate federal procurement of goods and services to impose vaccines on the employees of federal contractors and subcontractors? In other words, the power to spend money, right? Congress appropriates funds, says here's what you can spend it on. The actual spending is done. The execution of that spending is done by the executive branch, by the president. And the question is, can the president then suddenly put limits, requirements, mandates on that spending without Congress's authorization? And according to the judge, he believes that it's likely the answer is no. So we have two different judges finding two different reasons why a mandate on federal contractors may not be constitutional, may not be legal. And again, we're dealing with the opinion of individual judges. Here you have one judge that has decided, you know what, healthcare workers, it's a problem because because it may cause a lack of available healthcare services. You have another judge, and by the way, that impacts 10 states. You have another judge that says, listen, can the president actually change the rules that Congress set in place? He doesn't think so. That, by the way, affects three states, Kentucky, Ohio, and Tennessee. So now what we have at this point in the timeline is we have, 13 states where these mandates have different ways of enforcement. In other words, in Kentucky, Ohio, and Tennessee, the mandate against contractors is on hold. You can't do that. That's according to a judge. Whereas in the 10 states from the Missouri judge, well, that's only healthcare workers that's impacted. See, at this point, we have we don't have the equal protection of the laws, because if you happen to live in one state or work in one state, you have one set of rules. If you work in a different set of states, you have a different set of rules, all coming from a federal government. So it makes I don't like using the word fair. It's a very unjust situation. Imagine you and your spouse are both government contractors. Either you're considered government contractors because you're healthcare workers. That by itself is patently ridiculous, but we'll set that aside. But both of you are considered to be covered by the president's dictate, this announcement that he's going to put a mandate on federal contractors. Now, you happen to live, as I once did, right near a state border. One spouse works in one state, another spouse works in another state. One spouse is required to take the vaccine, the other spouse is not. Does that sound like a just environment to you? And again, this situation is in place not because of people we hire to represent us. These are not laws of Congress. Yes, it was the president who started all of this, but again, the president isn't elected by the people. He's elected by the states. Now, the people of the states tell the states how they want them to vote, but they're still the appointment of electors is still up to the legislature of the states. That's why if you look really close at your ballot, it says you're voting for electors for president, not for president themselves. But we're not done yet. See, another judge, this time in Louisiana, issued a preliminary injunction to block the vaccine mandate, again, for healthcare workers. So now we have Judge Terry Doherty in Monroe, Louisiana, who issued their own order to block this quote-unquote emergency regulation that was issued by CMS. So we're back to the Missouri judge, right? We're not focusing on all contractors. Now we're just focusing on healthcare workers. And in this case, Doherty argued that, you know what, the CMS lacked the constitutional authority to issue a vaccine mandate. In fact, in the opinion, Doherty wrote, there is no question that mandating a vaccine to 10.3 million healthcare workers is something that should be done by Congress, not a government agency. It is not clear that even an act of Congress mandating a vaccine would be constitutional. Well, hey, finally a judge that recognizes, wait a second, where's the constitutional authority for anybody in federal government to do this? So again, while these things are going through court, we have this temporary hold on this particular mandate. And again, we have one more group of states, one more individual temporarily setting the rules for different areas. And we have this hodgepodge mishmash of rules because individual judges have different individual opinions. Now, I am not complaining that attorneys general, that individuals, that businesses that are petitioning the government for a redress of grievance. I am not. This is definitely a grievance that needs to be dealt with. My concern is look at the three different judges. You have three different judges with three different reasons why they issued an injunction preventing the implementation of what is effectively an executive order, right? Biden tells CMS, issue this, you know, write up this mandate. Right, it's being done. Whatever CMS does is being done in the name and by the authority of the President of the United States. So we're not dealing with the rule of law. We're dealing with the rule of men. Biden decided he wanted a mandate. Did Congress give him the authority to create a mandate for federal employees? I don't think so. Did Congress give him the pass a law that authorized him that he is executing to impose his will on federal contractors? No. Did the Congress give a definition of federal contractors to include anybody that happens to take money from a federal program? No. Did the Constitution even give the United States the authority to make these decisions? No. So we're not dealing with the rule of law, we're dealing with the rule of men. And the only thing that is stopping President Biden from infringing on the rights of the American people are a handful of judges. And those judges are making their decisions for different reasons. Which means while all three of them have temporarily stayed the implementation of this mandate, as they look at the cases before them, since they are judging them on different terms, by different standards, for different reasons, they're just as likely to come up with different ultimate decisions. You know, this reminds me an awful lot of a line from the Declaration of Independence. In the list of grievances of why we declared independence from Great Britain, the very first grievance listed, he, the king, has refused his assent to laws the most wholesome and necessary for the public good. You see, the same judges that are being used to hold up the implementation of this mandate, well, that same process has been used to hold up the implementation of laws that are legitimate, that are legal. Anybody remember, was it Chief Justice Roberts saying that while the president had the authority to do something, he didn't like the way he did it? Therefore, he's going to, he was in the group that refused his assent to laws the most wholesome and necessary for the public good. See, this isn't simply the rule of man over the rule of law. It's the rule of which man or which woman. Do your rights fluctuate based on which judge happens to get your case? What district or circuit you happen to live in or work in? Where you're, you know, what district or circuit you may be sued in? What happens when we the people are no longer in charge of making laws? When our representatives that we hire are no longer the ones in charge of making laws? When that awesome power, that awesome duty is taken from the hands of the representatives of the people and placed in the hands of judges and justices, men and women in black robes, sitting on benches, believing they rule over the rest of the people. Now, I want to talk some more about this, but before I do, I have to take a break. And before I head to the break, I'd appreciate it if you head to constitutionstudy.com, find out more about what we do here at the Constitution Study. Maybe sign up for the newsletter. Maybe ask a question. I'm still looking for questions for my Q&A segments. So if you go to constitutionstudy.com/questions, or if you just hit the Ask a Question button on the menu, you can ask a question. Just mark it that you want to answer it on the radio, and I will be more than happy to do so here. So please check that out. Also, please check out healthycell.com. You know, that's right. We live in a world where we really need vitamins. The food we eat has changed. Much more of it's processed food. We don't get the proper nutrition that we need. And it affects us in many ways. Some of us have a problem focusing. Some of us have a decreased immune system. Some of us just have a hard time falling asleep. Well, Healthy Cell has changed the way they do vitamins. They've reinvented the vitamins to work at a cellular level to help your body do what it needs to do. And it's now pill-free. That's right. No fistful of pills to take. Now, they've got different formulas for what your body needs, but like I said, sometimes you have a hard time falling asleep. Now, my wife has had that for many, many years, and she's been using the REM sleep for a while. She loves it. It helps her get drowsy, helps her fall asleep and stay asleep so we can wake up and live our days refreshed and ready to go. Now, as America Out Loud listener, you get 20% off your first order. Just go to healthycell.com, try any of their products. Just make sure you use Out Loud at checkout. That's right. You can try the REM Sleep or any of their products. You get 20% off. Just make sure you use the promo code Out Loud at checkout.
Hail, my fellow Americans. How did you feel watching footage on the news of domestic terrorists looting our stores and burning our cities down? You were probably disgusted and angry as much as I was. It's disturbing what's going on. Well, you'd be shocked to know that your shopping habits are supporting these extremists. Companies like Amazon, Nike, Disney, FedEx, it's an endless list. and they've been supporting these radical groups. Let's stop supporting companies that fund these extremist groups. We can all do our part. Visit shoptotheright.com and you'll find businesses in a nationwide database and companies that are aligned with our American values. Visit shoptotheright.com and let's all make a difference.
I'm excited to talk about a new product from HealthyCell, AC11. This is a patented bioactive extract of Uncaria tomentosa from the Amazon rainforest. It supports cell DNA repair and health span. It's a dietary supplement. I'm excited to try it. Many are interested in longevity and attenuation of senescence. We know that telomere length and other biologic measures are related to senescence in clinical and preclinical studies, particularly of animal models. And I can tell you as a doctor, dietary supplements do hold the promise of attenuating repair and damage in our body due to stress, physical wear and tear, sunlight, etc. And there's a tremendous opportunity for supplements to help us in this area. And so HealthyCell has brought a product to market for you to try as part of your health portfolio. So please go to HealthyCell.com and in the promotional code, list out loud for 20% off your first purchase of products from HealthyCell. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Well, there was a time when Americans could rely on the Fourth Estate. Well, in these challenging times, the media is both reckless and complicit. AmericaOutloud.com. Top analysis from leading experts, articles, podcast, video, and 24/7 talk radio. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
Welcome back, everyday Americans. That's right, you've rejoined the Constitution Study. Today, we're asking the question, are we still a nation of laws, or do we have a government of laws, or a government of men? Specifically, the concept that a judge rules, that a judge can overrule pretty much anything they want. And again, I'm not focusing on the good or bad of the particular opinion that we're discussing here. It's the background to it, the concept of, do we make our own laws and are we bound by those laws? Are judges bound by those laws? I dealt a lot in the first half of this program with the Biden's vaccine mandate on federal workers and contractors, especially healthcare workers. I'm going to start taking a little different tack at the moment. See, recently, the members of the Ninth Circuit, they had an entire panel, and they held that California's ban on ammunition magazines is legitimate. See, California, again, I dealt with the same thing when I lived in New York. They have a ban on magazines that hold more than 10 rounds. Now, this case is Duncan versus Bonta. I'm kind of curious to see if this actually goes up to the Supreme Court. In the Ninth Circuit opinion, they said that this law only required intermediate scrutiny because it imposed a minimal burden on the right of self-defense. Okay, let's back up and start from the beginning. The Second Amendment to the Constitution of the Bill of Rights clearly states, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. It doesn't take a rocket science. It doesn't take a legal eagle. It simply says your right to keep and bear arms shall not. Not may not, not should not, not under, except under certain circumstances, shall not. So here we have the Ninth Circuit claiming that, well, it's a minimal infringement on a right. Now, interesting, they talk about the right of self-defense, except that's not what the Second Amendment says. It says our right to keep and bear arms is so that we can be part of a defense of the state, to keep the state secure. It needs a militia, and it needs people that are armed. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean you have to have an organized militia, right? It does say the regular militia being necessary to security of a free state. That's the premise. The premise is if you want to be free, if you want to live in a free state, we need a militia. Not an organized militia, not necessarily the National Guard, but we need that. But it goes on to say, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Period. End of story. So what do they say is this minimal burden? Well, we're only going to infringe a little bit. You know, it reminds me of a story, and I've used it here before, of, the kids go running to dad. They want to go see this brand new movie, but the one problem is the movie's R-rated. Now the kids say, oh no, it's a great movie, great story, great acting, great special effects. Yeah, there's a little bit of language in there and maybe a little bit of we'll just say overexposure of some of the actors, but it's a great movie. Just a little bit of bad stuff in it, Dad. Just a little. We should go. So Dad said, all right, kids, let me think about it. A little while later, he calls the kids into the kitchen and says, hey, I just made you some brownies. These are great brownies. I used the best ingredients, the freshest ingredients, the best chocolate. I did put a little bit of, dog stuff from the backyard. Just a little bit. And for some reason, the kids wouldn't eat it. See, when we talk about a little bit of infringement, you're still saying it's being infringed. And that's the problem we have here. This law infringes on the right of the people to keep and bear arms. And it does so because, in the opinion of a bunch of judges, they can infringe on your rights because it's a minimal infringement. So they refer to what is called intermediate scrutiny. Now, when you see scrutiny in opinion, when you see intermediate scrutiny, strict scrutiny, even you see things like history, text, and tradition, what you're asking, what the court is determining is how hard the government has to work to infringe on your rights. That's exactly what they're saying. They're saying, well, listen, because it's only a minimal burden, the government doesn't have to work that hard to infringe on your rights. It's only intermediate scrutiny. Now, the Constitution is the supreme law of the land. That means the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments, are the supreme law of the land. So here we have the law that says, no, your right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And you have men and women in black robes saying, well, we'll let the government infringe if we don't think it's too burdensome. Do you want to know where many of your rights disappeared? It disappeared when we let judges violate their oath of office. You see, judges take an oath to support the Constitution of the United States. Federal judges and state judges, but we're here talking federal judges. And the Constitution clearly states that a right to keep and bear arms is not to be infringed, period, end of story. But they don't care. They know better. And they believe they rule. Now, California is violating the Constitution. The legislators of California violated the Constitution when they passed this law. The governor who signed it violated his oath of office. The legislators violated their oath of office. The state courts violated their oath of office. And now the federal court has violated its oath of office. Tell me we have a government of laws when the law doesn't matter. Oh, Paul, but you've got this case and that case, and you've got constitutional law. That's not law. Ladies and gentlemen, it's not law. You can call it law, but it's not law. It's the opinion of judges. It said that Abraham Lincoln once walked into his cabinet and said, and asked a question. It says, if you call a trunk a leg, how many legs does an elephant have? Apparently somebody said five. He said, no. You can call a trunk a leg, that doesn't make it a leg. You can call the opinion of a judge constitutional law, that doesn't make it law, because it was not made pursuant to the Constitution. But that's where we stand. Your rights are no longer protected by the Constitution as long as we allow these judges to place their opinion above the language of the Constitution. Then we don't have, let's just say, the rule of law is gone. It's the rule of, well, whatever the Supreme Court eventually says, or whatever court it gets to before, you know, before there. The law is whatever a district court says, or a circuit court says, or the Supreme Court says. That's not a republic. That's an oligarchy. And that's what America in many ways has become. Now, the good news is we can fix it, but it's going to require we the people getting involved. But before I discuss that, what happens when judges become the supreme rule of the land? When the opinion of a judge supersedes the language of the law, the language of the Constitution, what happens? Well, I'm sure many of you are aware that the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in a case, Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health, also known as the Mississippi abortion law case. And there's a lot of speculation about what the court is going to find in its ultimate opinion. But I found this article with Senator Jean Shaheen, where she issued a warning to the Supreme Court before they actually heard oral arguments, claiming that a revolution will take place if the high court overturns existing precedent. This is in response to a question by Adam Sexton. She said, "I hope the Supreme Court is listening to the people of the United States because, to go back to Adam Sexton's question, I think if you want to see a revolution go ahead, outlaw Roe v. Wade and see what the response is of the public, particularly the young people, because I think that will not be acceptable to young women or young men." Oh, so now we're not even dealing with the rule of law or the rule of man. We're dealing with the rule of the mob. Well, that's what Senator Shaheen said. If you don't find the way we want, there's going to be a revolution. Now, let's stop and think about this. Senator Shaheen, well, she's a senator, right? Meaning she's part of the legislative body. Has she proposed a law that would validate or that would enshrine, that would encode a woman's right to terminate pregnancy? Maybe she has, maybe she hasn't. But the point is, Congress has not passed any such law. There is no law. Roe v. Wade's an opinion. That's all it is. A bad opinion based on faulty reasoning, and I can show that, and I will certainly be discussing more, especially when the opinion comes out. But even Senator Shaheen says, no, it's not simply because Congress hasn't done their job, in her opinion. She thinks the judges can outlaw an opinion. Well, wait a second, Roe v. Wade's not law. How could you outlaw something that's not law? But furthermore, this was done before oral arguments. So you have a member of the Senate attempting to intimidate the court, saying, pay no attention to the law. Pay no attention to Congress's actions. Pay no attention to the Constitution of the United States. If you don't do what I want, there are going to be people who will be upset. Well, you know what? There are going to be people who are upset on either side. And when she talks about particularly young people, I think she better check some of the polling, because support for abortion among young people has been falling. But now we've devolved from the rule of law to the rule of man to the rule of the mob. See, if Ms. Shaheen thought that the court might find Roe unconstitutional, why is she not proposing legislation to attempt to reinstate a right to abortion nationwide? Could it be because all the attempts to get abortion enshrined in U.S. code have failed? So those who wanted unlimited abortions went to the courts to overrule the law. And now that that's threatened, they are fighting back. And does now law matter only based on the response of the public? Imagine this. Imagine you're in the same position, in a similar position to Kyle Rittenhouse. Let's take the part of it. Let's just focus on the self-defense aspect. Let's say you are in a situation of self-defense, and in doing so, you kill the person who was threatening you. But you see, the mob doesn't like it for whatever reason. Maybe they don't like the race. Maybe they don't like the sexual preferences. Maybe they don't like the day of the week. Whatever. You decide to have a mob show up because they don't like the fact that the court looked at the case and said, no, this was self-defense. Do you want to be sent to jail because not because you did something wrong, but because the mob doesn't like what you did? And tell me, where's the ethics complaint against Senator Shaheen? You see, it's not exactly witness tampering, but it is an attempt to influence the opinion of the judges. Now, if she wanted to influence the opinions of the judges legally, she could have filed an amicus brief. She could have said, here's my opinion. Here's the legal basis for it. This is why you shouldn't do it. Go ahead. She didn't do that. She answered in public. And again, she didn't say, this is why Roe v. Wade is constitutional. She didn't say, this is why it is legal. This is why No. She simply said, if you get rid of this unlawful law, this opinion that we call law, there's going to be a revolution. And a revolution, well, isn't that insurrection? Isn't this possibly inciting to riot? Yet I don't hear anybody filing ethics complaints. I don't hear anybody filing articles of impeachment. But it's not just congressmen and women. See, body cam footage came out recently showing an MSNBC freelancer who was following the bus carrying the jury in the Rittenhouse trial. Now, interesting, apparently this MSNBC freelancer, James Morrison, was following and in doing so ran a red light. So he's pulled over and off and given a traffic citation. Somewhere in this, there's body cam footage of, I believe, Mr. Morrison trying to explain to himself. And he told the police that a supervisor, NBC producer Irene Byron, instructed him to follow the bus. Apparently then Morrison called NBC's Irene Byron and had her talk to the officer. And she brings up that he's following a jury bus. So here you have members, plural, members of the media that are, you have a jury. I don't know if they were, how sequestered they were. They're following him. They want to know where they are. Why? See, the interesting thing about a jury trial is a jury trial, while the judge has a lot of influence, the ultimate decision is not in the hands of a judge. It's in the hands of everyday people, a jury of your peers. But here we have media following them. I won't try to read their mind and figure out why they were following them. Maybe they just wanted to know where they were going. Maybe they just wanted some B-roll footage. Maybe they thought they'd find something spicy. Maybe they might try to, influence the output. I mean, imagine the jury's probably not supposed to be watching the news, but hey, MSNBC exclusive. This is where the jurors are. I can't see a lot of good reasons for news media to be following the jurors after the trial right? Should after the day in the courtroom, right? Because the trial is still going on. Sounds a little bit more like rule of the mob. And again, imagine you're one of those jurors. It's bad enough you already know that if you acquit him, there's likely to be violence and rioting. And if you find Rittenhouse guilty, you might be sending an innocent man to jail. But then to be followed by the news media. Could it be they were trying to figure out who these people were so they could expose, they could dox them, they could let their information out? If not directly, maybe second or third hand? I don't know. Certainly doesn't smell kosher. But there was one other thing that came out that's still coming out on the Rittenhouse story, and that's the outcome. See, there are three lawmakers in Wisconsin that have introduced a plan to make it illegal for anyone under 18 to carry a rifle or a shotgun unless they are hunting. In a joint statement by Senators Bob Wirch and Representatives Olmstead and McGuire, quote, while Wisconsin law generally prohibits a minor from possessing a dangerous weapon, there is an exception which allows a minor to possess a long gun or rifle if the barrel is no longer than 16 inches. This exception was made to respect Wisconsin's sporting heritage. This bill simply clarifies that a minor may only possess a long gun or rifle if they are legally hunting and in compliance with hunting laws. Now, at least this is representatives of the state of Wisconsin trying to get law passed. I think it's a bad law for a couple of reasons. The biggest reason is, apparently, my guess would be these members of the legislature of Wisconsin didn't like the outcome in the Rittenhouse trial. Therefore, they're trying to change the law. They can't apply it back to Kyle Rittenhouse, but they don't like the fact that, you know, hey, if you are under 18, you're still allowed to carry a rifle. Why do I have a problem with this? Well, when I was a kid, I carried a rifle all the time. And not always for hunting. Sometimes it was for target shooting. Sometimes it was for competition. So now these lawmakers don't want minors to exercise their constitutionally protected right because they don't like the way somebody used it. Somebody used them. And I can see a lot of bad things coming out of this. This is the problem when we make laws based on emotion rather than facts and details. This is what happens when we allow judges to make law, and then we have legislators trying to make law to change what a judge does. In this case, what a jury did. These three men didn't like what the jury did, so they're going to change the law. Now, that is at least the proper way to go about doing it, right? Is to change the law, not simply to rewrite the law. But this whole concept of, is the rule of law matter anymore? But this whole episode reminds me of Federalist Paper number 78, written by Alexander Hamilton, in which he said, whoever attentively considers the different departments of power must perceive that, in a government in which they are separated from each other, the judiciary, from the nature of its functions, will always be the least dangerous to the political rights of the Constitution, because it will be least in a capacity to annoy or injure them. The executive not only dispenses the honors, but holds the sword of the community. The legislature not only commands the purse, but describes the rules by which the duties and rights of every citizen are to be regulated. The judiciary, on the contrary, has no influence over either the sword or the purse, no direction of either the strength or the wealth of the society, and can take no active resolution whatever. It may truly be said to have neither force nor will, but merely judgment, and must ultimately depend upon the aid of the executive arm, even for the efficacy of its judgments. Does that sound like the judiciary to you today? Doesn't sound like it today. Today, it seems almost all the power is being exercised by the judiciary. Congress passed a law, state passes the law. It only is effective if a court says so. The executive issues a policy or regulation, it's only effective if the courts say so. Now, don't get me wrong. Courts are important. The judiciary is important. We need it as a way to petition for a redress of grievance. But when their opinions are elevated to the level of law, they are no longer simply the judiciary. They become the very royals we declared independence from. The oligarchs that rule on high, their opinions questioned only by their peers. How do you overrule a judge? You can write a law, but the judge can simply say, well, that law is unconstitutional. You can pass a constitutional amendment. They can say, well, we interpret that with certain scrutiny, which means we can get away with it anyway. So what do we do? What can we do? Well, the answer is right there in the Constitution of the United States. Article 2, Section 4. The President, Vice President, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. If we have judges that are circumventing the rule of law, if they are violating their oath of office, if they are placing their peers' opinions above the supreme law of the land, that certainly should rise to a crime, a high crime. It should at least be a misdemeanor, bad actions, bad conduct. And there was a time when we saw judges impeached. In fact, I've been told the judges early in the country were impeached for being intoxicated while off duty for fear that their bad morals could lead to them being compromised in their decisions. But you see, the only people who can impeach a judge are your representatives in the House. Article 1, Section 2. The House of Representatives shall choose a speaker and shall have the sole power of impeachment. Now, Thomas Jefferson was concerned that impeachment would become a scarecrow, something that was threatened but rarely used. Sadly, that has been the case. It is time that we, the people, through our representatives, establish better standards for those who sit on the bench, and it's up to us to force them to do it. You can find out more about my show, get all the latest podcasts, just go to the menu under AmericaOutloud.com, look under our shows or schedules, you'll find the Constitution Study, and help prepare to defend the blessings of liberty for yourself and your posterity.
Paid bills, stay out of jail.